listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, in the Trayvon Martin case, we'll get to that as the day goes on. The juror who is speaking to the press, the one with the lawyer and the book deal, a lawyer for a husband, and, well, actually, now she says she doesn't have a book deal. She does have an agent. Who knows what's going on? Anyhow, she says that one of the things that influenced her most strongly in the decision was the one thing that the judge said, don't let this influence your decision. You're not to consider it. That the chief investigator said he believed George Zimmerman. The chief investigator, of course, was the guy who decided not even to arrest George Zimmerman, so he had his own butt to protect and reputation. But anyhow, that's a whole giant can of worms that, it's, you know, anything goes summer, we can discuss. The so-called limited nuclear option, an actual nuclear option would be you can't filibuster legislation unless you stand and talk. You know, the real talking filibuster, which is what Jeff Merkley is pushing for, and I think would be a great idea. Well, this isn't being considered. Harry Reid threatened a limited nuclear option, which was, you know, requiring a simple majority of votes simply for nominees, for presidential nominees. Not for judges, not for laws, just for nominees. And the Republicans said, okay, we'll tell you what. We'll give you that if the president withdraws two of his NLRB nominations and organized labor has some say in nominating two others, and then we'll approve that. So basically, the Constitution says that the president gets to appoint these people. And the Republicans said, okay, we'll go along with this if you just ignore what the Constitution says and if the president kind of, you know, self-emasculates. Now, the White House hasn't weighed in on this, but presumably they're going to go along with this. And arguably, it's a victory for the Democrats. I mean, at least the Democrats are aggressively spinning it that way. The Republicans are saying, you know, say, why did you do this? Well, according to John McCain, he said that the Senate was embarrassed because their approval rating is just below that of a colonoscopy. And according to Senator Lindsey Graham, he said the Republicans went along with it because it prevented the 12% approval rating that the Senate has from dropping down to 4%, which would be way below a colonoscopy. But anyhow, it's interesting times in the political world. And part of those interesting times are the consequences of the 2012 election. The Republicans lost the House of Representatives by 1.5 million votes, yet they control the House of Representatives. What's that about? The Republicans lost seats in the Senate, and yet, with a minority, they're able to be the tail that wags the dog of the Senate, as I was just describing. And the President of the United States seems not able to get a whole lot done, and what he can get done, like his health care reform, now he's backing off for a year on, at least on the employer mandate portion of it. And Republicans are gleeful about that. Which is not to say he hasn't gotten a lot of good stuff done, but it sure seems like the Republicans don't back down and the Republicans and the Democrats do more often than not. But anyhow, what actually happened in 2012? I mean, I just shared you my perspective on this. Let's go to the far other side of the aisle, as it were. Dr. Jerome Corsi was the fellow who brought you Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, the book, who brought you the book about Obama's hidden gay life, that he's actually gay. And now has a new book out, What Went Wrong, the inside story of the GOP debacle in 2012 and how it can be avoided next time. Dr. Jerome Corsi, website, WorldNet Daily is where you write, WND.com, Jerry Corsi. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, thanks, Tom. How are you?
I am well. I hope you are.
Yes, thank you.
So in reading your book, it seems like, well, actually, I think I can summarize it in your own words from your own book, that the reason Barack Obama won the presidency, you say that the 2012, Obama's 2012 election strategy, bribing interest groups needed to establish a winning coalition, wooing women voters by accusing Republicans of waging a war on women, changing the president's position yet again on same-sex marriage to buy homosexual votes, playing for Hispanic votes by issuing executive decrees that enact by presidential fiat provisions of the DREAM Act, and bribing students with promises of student loan rate extensions and bribing homeowners with mortgage rate deductions. And then you go on to say, but that gets a candidate to the top, but to get over the top, the last few votes necessary to win an election, the Democratic Party has engaged in the systematic vote registration of a shadow group of illegal aliens, felons, dead people, multiple state voters, and assorted others in a massive nationwide campaign of voter fraud. You say the techniques Democrats used to get Obama elected involved coaching students in how to vote for Obama in a state where they were attending college, and then again by absentee ballot in the state where their parents resided, by encouraging Obama supporters to vote by absentee ballot in states where they formerly resided, as well as in the states where they currently reside, and by finding voters to present themselves to vote by assuming the identity of someone Democratic campaign officials knew would not show up in person to vote, including deceased individuals still listed on the voter registration rolls. So, in other words, President Obama won because he stole the election. Do I have that right?
Tom, I got to credit you. That's the best bias description I've ever heard.
Well, I just was reading from your own book.
No, I don't recall those passages being.
Okay, it's I was reading verbatim from page 161 and page 163.
I'll take a look at them while we're talking.
Okay. Great. The first thing I read was the paragraph at the bottom of page 161, and then the second thing I read was the third paragraph. I read it in its entirety, every single word, from beginning to end, the third paragraph on page 163, and that's all I read.
All right. That's all you read?
That's correct. I mean, I identified what I was reading as by saying, let me read from your book.
Well,
the stuff before that was my words, obviously.
Yeah, right. Let's not quibble about it. I've been looking at the paragraphs now. I think you embellished a bit. At any rate, Tom, look, I'm saying that Obama won by playing interest group politics. I mean, that's not a unfair or, strategy. It goes back to FDR. FDR created a New Deal coalition by playing interest group politics. And in fact, I say Obama did it very well.
Well, isn't that what politicians are supposed to do? They're supposed to do what the people who are voting for them want them to do? I mean, isn't that the whole point of having a representative democracy?
Well, except that when you target as hard as Obama targeted and target groups that are potentially promising them things that are incompatible. I mean, the Hispanic groups with the DREAM Act and with also promised, jobs in the United States, we're having a declining employment environment. Black Americans have had the highest unemployment rate in history under Obama.
So politicians should not promise jobs.
Well, they should promise, but they should also deliver. An interest group politics.
Oh, we were losing 800,000 jobs a month when Obama took office. We've had 30 plus straight months of over 100,000 jobs a month.
Okay, created. Well, I'm just pointing out the some of the demands that have been presented. Interest group politics always promises more than you can deliver.
Well, sure. I mean, George W. Bush did it with politics. Hey, we're going to end abortion and we're going to get prayer back in school and everything else. I'm curious. Do you still think that Obama is gay?
Tom, I never wrote a book saying Obama was gay.
No, you wrote an article. The title is Obama Hid Gay Life to Become President.
Well, it's not on the subject we're here to discuss, Tom.
I was just curious.
I wrote a couple of articles quoting people in Chicago who've made that claim.
Right. Do you think it's true?
As far as I'm concerned, they gave me documentation of it.
Okay. Do you still think that you also suggested that he was actually Kenyan and concealing his identity? Do you still stand behind that?
Tommy had a book publicist out for years saying he was born in Kenya and raised in Indonesia.
Right.
Better ask Barack Obama why he did that.
Okay, we'll do it. Jerry Corsi. Hang on just a second, Jerry.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Jerry Corsi's new book, What Went Wrong? The Inside Story of the GOP Debacle of 2012 and How It Can Be Avoided. And you can read all about it over at WND.com. Jerry, thank you.
Sure, Tom. Thank you.
Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, Jerry Corsi wanted to say that the election was stolen by Acorn. And my old friend Brad Friedman has some thoughts on this. He publishes bradblog.com, as well as being a radio show host. And Brad and Desi do some amazing reporting on green issues and on political issues and on voter fraud issues and all kinds of other things. And Brad, thank you for calling. Hey, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you? I had to call in because I had to confirm. Did Jerome Corsi just dispute the very words that were written in his own book?
It sounds like that to me. I mean, I will read to you his own words again, if you would like. Just a couple sentences of them, anyway.
Yeah.
He said, but to get, this is the first paragraph of page 162. But he first of all, he talks about, you know, bribing gays and Hispanics and whatnot and how they did it. And he says, but to get his candidate over the top with the last few votes necessary to win an election, the Democratic Party has engaged in the systematic vote registration of a, quote, shadow group, end quote, of illegal aliens, felons, dead people, multiple state voters, and assorted others in a massive nationwide campaign to enable voter fraud. In a close election, as few as 100,000 fraudulent votes in a hotly contested battleground state could be calculated to tip the balance.
I see. And
end of quote.
When you read
verbatim.
That, yeah, you read that, and then he seemed to dispute it and say that you were embellishing by reading what he said.
Yes.
I was kind of hoping that he would actually follow it up with some evidence for these extraordinary claims, because
yes.
As you may know, Tom, there is no such evidence to back up his extraordinary claims.
That's correct. And in fact, I probably, instead of, you know, giving the news of the day when I opened the segment, I probably should have just gone right to Jerry, because I wanted to ask him, and this is the question that has been troubling me ever since I read his book, or I skimmed his book before, you know, prior to the interview, was these are felonies that he's talking about. I mean, having, you know, being a student and voting in Madison, Wisconsin, where you're going to school, and then voting in Lansing, Michigan, where you were born, is a felony. It's like, you know, depending on the state, anywhere from 2 to 10 years in prison. And if he is so certain that hundreds of thousands of people in one state, 100,000 people, if hundreds of thousands of people have committed these felonies, then why are they not being prosecuted? There are plenty of prosecutors in this country who are Republicans. There are entire states that are controlled by Republicans. And you know, in Wisconsin, they passed the voter ID law, and they had to come before Congress and present some reason for it. I know you reported on this. What was the consequence of the investigations that the Republicans did looking for these dead voters and these double voters that Jerry Corsi is talking about?
Yeah, we had just a report released by the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division just before the July 4 holiday, so nobody probably noticed it, but an 18-month probe looking into claims by the Republican AG there that there were 953 dead people who voted in South Carolina elections. Turns out the number was somewhat off. It was actually zero dead people.
Right.
And most people haven't heard about that because, you know, they released the report just before the 4th of July holiday. Every time we look into these reports, they turn out to be completely stuff and nonsense. And you're right. If he has this evidence, this extraordinary evidence of voter fraud, why isn't he giving it to law enforcement authorities? I was on the air some years ago with David Horowitz, who I'm sure you know.
I've debated David many times on this program.
Yeah, right winger, and you know, who claimed that a family member of his, and we hear this all the time, a family member of his was in a nursing home, and you know, the people who care for them were committing voter fraud. And I asked him, well, what nursing home, and have you reported this to the police? At which time he became irate, said he wouldn't tell me what nursing home it is, admitted he hadn't reported it to anyone. So you would think with all these right wingers familiar with all of this voter fraud, they would want to see some accountability for it, yet somehow they never turn in their evidence to anyone for some reason.
Yeah, well, this is the point I've been making for a long, long time, is that if they could find one person in the United States. Now, I understand, I said Wisconsin. Thank you for correcting me. It was South Carolina. Or North Carolina? It was South Carolina, wasn't it?
It was South Carolina,
South Carolina,
but
yeah.
You should know there's also no massive voter fraud going on in Wisconsin either.
Or anywhere else. And there was one state, and I'm sure you know which state it was. You follow this stuff you know, really, really well, and you're a much better reporter than I am. And on this issue, this was this what they found was they found basic maybe it was Arizona or something like that. They found one person who had voted and was ineligible to vote, and it was a woman who had forgotten to register when she moved. And then there was another state where they found like 12 people that turned out like they were felons and they didn't realize that they were not eligible to vote. I mean, there's a couple of these kind of instances.
Yeah.
There have been maybe 30 or 40 of these a year nationwide after spending tens of millions of dollars looking for them. And they actually prosecute these people. But if there was if there was even one person who was found who actually double voted with the intention of swinging an election or organized 100 or 200 people to double vote, that person would be more famous than Trayvon Martin.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, there is voter fraud. Voter fraud does happen. The key is, however, it usually happens via absentee ballot, which has nothing to do with the polling place photo ID restrictions that Republicans, you know, are trying to put in place all around the country. That's why they're doing this. They want to restrict people
of
from
course.
Voting, not keep fraud from happening. And all of these cases, if you look at them, going back, there was just a major report by a news consortium looking at every single case of election fraud in all 50 states going back to the year 2000. They found exactly 10 cases. Out of hundreds of millions of votes cast, 10 cases that might have been stopped by polling place photo ID restrictions.
Right. And that is worth disenfranchising hundreds of thousands of poor people, young people, old people, people of color, urban dwellers who don't own cars. It's worth disenfranchising them and spending tens of millions of dollars of voter of taxpayer money. Brad Friedman, bradblog.com. Thank you, Brad.
Thanks, Tom.
Always good talking with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Brad is an absolutely brilliant reporter on these topics. He's one of the best. I don't even claim to be a reporter. I rant. Brad is a brilliant reporter. Yeah, I think one of the most revealing things, the juror, B-37, had to say to Anderson Cooper the other night on CNN when she was out there trying to set up her book deal or whatever she's trying to do, was that in her opinion, George Zimmerman felt fear. He was terrified. Apparently, it never occurred to her that Trayvon Martin felt fear. Now, this is a white juror. Trayvon Martin was a young black man. The defense lawyers were continually playing the race card, particularly at the end where they were holding up pictures of Trayvon Martin. You know, strapping young black guy, look at this, you know, picture with his naked chest flexing his biceps. Be afraid, be very afraid. It apparently never occurred to her that this kid might be afraid for his life, too. And he had a reason to be. He actually lost his life. This is the, I think more than anything else, this juror's comment demonstrates how powerful and pervasive racism is, at the same time that it demonstrates how subtle and unconscious it is. There's no doubt in my mind, if you were to ask her, are you a racist, she would have said no. And yet she was identifying with George Zimmerman rather than Trayvon Martin. She was concerned about what he felt, how he was reacting in the middle of a situation which he himself provoked, which he started against the advice of the police, against the training he had been given by the neighborhood watch people. George feared for his life, even though he had in his hand a loaded gun. Now, why Anderson Cooper did not ask her, has it occurred to you that Trayvon Martin might have feared for his life? Or has it occurred to you that George Zimmerman might have had less reason to fear for his life because he had a loaded gun in his hand? I can't say why Anderson Cooper didn't ask those questions, and I'm not suggesting that Anderson Cooper is a racist. What I am saying, and I want to say this very clearly, is that at some level, some very subtle, some very deep level, one that most, particularly white people, are unaware of, that we're all racists. That we all have a certain level of those kinds of assumptions built into our worldview. Of we'll identify with the guy who's like us rather than the guy who's not first. And if you're on a jury and your job is to evaluate the truth, then it's really important to set aside that unconscious racism, that institutionalized racism, that acculturated racism, that arguably very human with you from the time you were little racism. It's very important to set that aside. Let me rephrase that. It's very important to see it and acknowledge it so that you can then set it aside. And in this trial of George Zimmerman for the murder of Trayvon Martin, the judge did not allow that. Judge Nelson said, you may not use the word racial to the prosecution when you define the kind of profiling that was done of Trayvon Martin. In fact, both the prosecution and the defense went out of their way to say to the jury, this is not about race, which is a fancy way of saying, don't even consider the fact that your preconceptions, the way you just walk around in the world, may have a tinge, an element of racism to it. There's a lot of black people in this country. There's a relatively small number of them who are criminals. And yet, many of the people, at least apparently one of the people on that jury, looks at black people and goes, uh-oh. Or thinks, hey, if I was alone at night encountering a black man, uh-oh. That should have been front and center, in my opinion. That conversation should have been front and center. And in fact, that conversation is the beginning of the national conversation on race that we need to be having. The fact that, as we talked about a couple days ago on this program, maybe it was yesterday, that a white person being followed by a black person at night in this society is most likely, if they are afraid, if they do think that that person has ill intent toward them, is most likely thinking, I might get robbed, I might get beaten up. Or if it's a woman, you know, I might get raped. But a black person being followed by a white person in this society particularly since Emmett Till, but all the way back to when the first slaver came to America, Christopher Columbus, over 500 years ago, a black person being followed by a white person should more rightly be thinking, and in my the conversations that I've had with African Americans more often than not is thinking, not I might get robbed, I might get raped, I might get beaten up. They're thinking I might get killed and that white person will get away with it. Or I might get killed because white people have a long history of killing black people and getting away with it. As Joe Madison pointed out on our program yesterday, 4% of the population of Colorado is African American. So what is the percentage of African Americans on death row in Colorado? 100%. Does that mean that white people don't kill black people in Colorado? No. No, it happens. They just don't end up on death row. In many cases, they just don't even end up in jail. So, anyhow, Harry Reid, the nuclear option, the Democrats sort of having some spine here, but sort of not by saying, okay, we'll compromise with you Republicans. We'll give you two NLRB nominees, and we'll see how this works out. I'm still very skeptical that Harry Reid is letting the Republicans define the terms of the game, even though that definition is one that's largely face-saving for the Republicans. It's still face-saving for the Republicans, and frankly, they should have had their face shoved in this thing. Patrick in Pacifica, California. Hey, Patrick, what's on your mind? You wanted to talk about Harry Reid.
Well, yes. It was a little bit stunning to hear about that. Why should I be stunned that Obama is compromising? Actually, one of the things I just prior to your show, Greg Palast was talking about Richard Iglesias inspiring for not arresting somebody on voter fraud, and the Karl Rove and his company's complicity and all that.
Right.
This sort of ties in with a couple of recent Supreme Court decisions recently that are really bothersome. And one of them is the one on the Voting Rights Act. And, of course, the other one is the big one is the Citizens United. You know, just last month I was in Europe for 15 days. I went through 8 countries and went to the CERN, you know, and to do a sort of a dry run for my students next year. But I talked to a lot of people, and the number one thing that was on people's minds, you know, people are really pretty astute and sophisticated in their understanding of American history and contemporary politics. So folks really love Americans, they love America, but their number one thing that was on their mind at the time was Guantanamo, believe it or not.
No, I do believe it.
Yeah, the image of tubes down people's noses and throats, detainees whose right for fair trial is almost beatific.
Well, and it's because it's going on. It's going on every single day, and we're force-feeding people who have been already adjudicated innocent. And we won't let them out. We won't let them go to the country that they're from. We're keeping them in. I mean, it's Guantanamo, and our own president has come out and said Guantanamo is a blot. The Republicans in Congress are saying, sorry.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I honestly don't know if the Republicans in Congress are keeping Guantanamo open because they want to continue to humiliate the president. I think that's probably the main reason, or because they're really so terrified. Talk media for the rest of us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Caleb in Lake Oswego, Oregon. Hey, Caleb, what's on your mind today?
Sir, I love you. I love your insights on the Zimmerman thing, and I enjoy your podcast. But, you know,
listening
to Corsi, too, are you familiar with the term motivated reasoning?
No. Logic would indicate that it's reasoning that has been twisted by an agenda, but...
Yeah, no, exactly correct. Chris Mooney describes it wonderfully in his book, The Republican Brain. And what he says is that if you have a stake, some sort of emotional stake in believing something, like you're opposed to global warming, you think tobacco is good for you or whatever, the more information we give you, it will not persuade you at all. You will simply come up with counter-arguments, and that's exactly true with Corsi and the woman on the panel, too, who voted, I think, to exonerate Zimmerman.
Yes.
And, you know, it's just whatever fact you have, they will come up with other arguments. So, therefore, arguing with them doesn't really make too much sense. They do not come to the table with an open mind. Democrats, liberals, tend to be, I think, better at that, and that's why the top scientists identify with the Democratic Party rather than the Republican Party. But there's a thread of you know, I have my conclusion, and I'm going to find every single data point to support it, and I don't care what the other side says.
Yeah, don't try to confuse me with facts.
Right. Motivated reasoning.
Yeah. Okay. Caleb, I'm with you. And I think that that's there's a large piece of that. That said, I think it's really important that we listen to people like Jerry Corsi because he speaks for a large and not inconsequential part of this country, of the Republicans and the right-wingers and the libertarians in this country who tend to be marginalized and laughed at by the media and by the left. And I think that we do both at our peril, at considerable peril. So, Caleb, thanks a lot for the call. Alan in Muskegon, Michigan. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Well, Tom, I was calling about the Zimmerman case, but mm-hmm. your recent conversation brought to mind a quote from Mark Twain. Conservatism is the blind and fear-filled worship of dead radicals.
Hmm.
Now, with regard to the Zimmerman case, we talk about in criminal cases that a person, the defendant, is to be tried by a jury of his peers.
Right.
As a lawyer for over 40 years, in both criminal defense and prosecution, it appeared to me in this case that the entire courtroom was Zimmerman's peers. Every one of them was white.
Well, other than the Martin family. Oh, you mean all the people who had officers Martins, of the court, as it were.
All the
lawyers.
All of the defense witnesses.
Right.
And particularly, the defense put on was a woman from that neighborhood whose house had been invaded, and she and her small children, I guess, hid somewhere.
Yep.
And she pointed out how it was young black men who had participated in this invasion. Nothing
right.
to do with the case. The
right.
prosecution didn't even object to that, and the judge made no statement either, except in the very beginning to suggest that race had nothing to do with the case.
Right.
This case was blown from day one. Even the cops at the very beginning blew the case.
Right. And then they continued to, this is where, I mean, this juror B37 has said that, you know, one of the things that really influenced her, even though the judge said don't take into consideration what this man just said, one of the things that really influenced her was the lead investigator saying that he believed George Zimmerman's version of, or he found George Zimmerman, you know, truth, high level of truthiness, to use a Stephen Colbert phrase. the lead investigator had recommended that George Zimmerman be let go and you know that it was a self-defense case, you know, stand your ground self-defense case. And they did let him go. They didn't breathalyze him. They didn't take his blood. They didn't scrape his finger. I mean, they did none of the forensic stuff that you would typically do when you've got somebody dead on the ground and you got somebody standing over them holding a gun.
Yeah, and the idea that was suggested by the defense attorney that if the roles had been reversed, somehow the black guy who did the shooting would have walked away is absolutely ludicrous.
Well, it's not only ludicrous. That is as close as I heard to an overt statement of racism by the defense lawyers. I mean, the subtle racism, selecting which pictures of Trayvon to show and selecting witnesses who would, you know, portray black people in that neighborhood as very scary and all that kind of stuff, you know, was playing to racist sentiments. But then saying, you know, had George Zimmerman been black, he wouldn't have even been prosecuted, was like saying then the black community would not have gotten activated, they would not have complained, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, that may be. The black community might not have gotten activated and they might not have complained, but they wouldn't have, because the shooter would have been in jail instantly. And what activated the African-American community down in Florida and around the country was that an African-American kid was killed by somebody who was not an African-American, and he got away with it. And it wasn't just the outrage about George Zimmerman and getting away with it. It was the outrage over the Stand Your Ground law. And I think that's where our focus needs to be now, is outing the American Legislative Exchange Council and its funders, the Koch brothers, and the National Rifle Association for these Stand Your Ground laws. I think that they are just a crime. Alan, thanks for the call. Jean-Paul, in Carlsbad, California. Got a little less than a minute, Jean-Paul. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling you because it has something to do basically with the filibuster problem, and that's basically that the Democrats don't have the votes that they need to get legislation through the House or to get nominees approved through the Senate. I've been trying for some time to get the Democratic Party to understand that there are a couple of very large constituencies out there that are largely ignored by both political parties, and those constituencies are animal rights activists and what I call foodies, people that are concerned about the quality and safety of their food. I know you have sympathy with both of those things, and I've tried to get this message through to Democratic leaders, and I haven't been able to get through to anyone of any importance. I've now put these ideas into a fictional novel that I'm trying to get out, and what I'd like to do is send you one, and
Jean-Paul, I get probably a dozen books a day here. Post it over on our website at tomhartman.com. I'll take a look at it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just, along the same lines of what I was talking about in the last hour of, you know, getting inside the heads of white people and black people and how we view each other. Just in normal day-to-day, you know, what was in the side, the head of juror B-37, all that kind of thing. Let's check in with one of the more famous white pastors from Florida, Bill Keller, the Reverend Bill Keller. He's the founder of Live Prayer. LivePrayer.com is his website. Over 2.4 million subscribers to his daily devotional. And Reverend Keller, welcome.
Tom, always good to be with you. Bless your listeners.
Thank you. You write in an article titled A Different Look at the Zimmerman Case, and I quote your words, "The facts were clear that Trayvon Martin had more than enough time to get back to his father's house, but chose instead to confront Zimmerman, break his nose, and continue the violent attack. It sickens me that President Obama had to chime in to fan the flames of racism. The autopsy showed that he, Martin, had marijuana in his system at the time of the incident. A forensic look at his phone showed that in the 3 months prior to the tragic incident, Martin had pictures of pot and guns, as well as numerous text messages about fighting. It was apparent from his cell phone he was infatuated with smoking pot, guns, and fighting, all within the months leading up to the fateful night in Sanford." Am I correctly quoting you, sir?
You absolutely are. And, of course, that's all in the context of the real issue that I brought up in that article, which is parenting. Had Trayvon Martin's parents been real parents in the probably months and years, to be honest with you, leading up to this incident, it may never have happened.
You know his parents?
No, but what we do know is he was suspended from school at least three times in the last 6 months prior to this incident. We do know he was infatuated.
I was suspended from school twice when I was in junior high school. Does that mean that I should be shot?
And Tom, what did your parents do when you were suspended?
My dad walked me back into the school and gave the principal hell. I was suspended for publishing an underground newspaper. They eventually kicked me out of high school.
Well, Trayvon Martin was suspended for having burglary tools, stolen merchandise, and pot in his locker. So it's a little different story.
He deserved to die.
No, nobody said that. What I'm saying is, an issue that nobody wants to talk about is the parenting aspect of this. If these parents have been involved in his life, let me ask you a question.
Turn this fan off, too, please.
No, Tom, listen to me just 1 second. If you had a 16-year-old child and he had been kicked out of school three times for the offenses I named, which are all documented. If he had on his cell phone pictures of him smoking pot, brandishing guns, text messages back and forth,
then he should be executed by George Zimmerman.
What would you do?
I would not call George Zimmerman and say, please track him down and kill him.
No, no, you wouldn't. But you would definitely try to steer your child back into a more correct path, wouldn't you?
George Zimmerman is the guy who pulled the trigger.
I'm asking about the Martin Parrish.
George Zimmerman is the guy who pulled the trigger. Why are you not asking these questions about the guy who pulled the trigger?
Well,
have you looked at George Zimmerman's cell phone to see what was on that in the prior 3 months?
Anybody could. The FBI's already looked at that.
Have you bothered to look it up?
Pardon me?
Have you bothered to look it up? Have you examined what George Zimmerman was doing in the 3 months prior to his execution of Trayvon Martin?
It wasn't stalking young black men looking to kill them, Tom, and you know that.
I beg your pardon?
It was not stalking young black men looking to shoot them.
You think that George Zimmerman in the 3 months prior to his killing Trayvon Martin was not stalking young black men?
Not to kill them. He was obviously looking at the crime in his neighborhood, which
how
is a
would you know that
thing
his,
to look
How
at.
Would you know that his intention was not to kill a young black man unless he did it?
Listen, number one, we know what
which
happened
he did.
Because the evidence came out. He was confronted by Martin. His nose was broken. He was being beat to a bloody pulp on the sidewalk. That's fact, Tom. Nobody can argue that.
No, the bloody pulp is a wild exaggeration. And whether
Why
Trayvon Martin.
Anybody
actually,
want to talk
Bill,
about
none
issue.
Of those things are facts.
Pardon me?
None of those things are facts. They were
they
not even presented
trial,
as facts.
Didn't you watch?
Of course, I'm familiar with the evidence in the trial.
And that's what the jury ruled on, and that's why they voted him not guilty.
Yeah, I got that.
Okay. Now,
they did not
why
vote.
Doesn't want anybody want to confront the fact that the Martin parents, these wonderful people sat in court all these months, if they, I submit to you, if they had been as
you're calling
as
them wonderful and you're calling them bad parents at the same time. You're calling them wonderful and bad parents at the same time.
No,
Bill,
do you not
get the incredible
in
level?
To the extent they were the last year and a half, this may never have happened.
Do you not get the incredible level of racism that seems to be interlaced and interlayered into the comments that you're making, like pasta and lasagna?
Well, can I ask you a question? Why is the media not worried about the hundreds of young black men that are killed by other black men every day in our cities? Or more important, how about the 1,000 black babies that are slaughtered in this nation every 24 hours? Well, of course, that doesn't make Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and Ben Jealous and the race baiters any money, so they don't want to talk about that. They take these isolated incidents. By the way, have they ever...
You know, I got it. You want to change the subject, Bill, but let me ask the question again. Do you not realize how racist you sound right now?
I'm not. Listen, anybody that has followed me knows that I have not a racist bone. Listen, we have done more.
How do you know you're not a racist?
Tom, let me tell you something. Out of the 2.4 million subscribers to my devotional, over 600,000 are black people. Okay, I started my ministry in the South Side.
Therefore,
of
you're not a racist.
Black churches. Pardon me.
Therefore, you're not a racist.
I'm not a listen. There's only one race to me, the human race. Any follower of Jesus Christ understands it's not a black race, a white race, a yellow race, a red race, a brown race. It's one race, the human race. We've all been
created.
Well,
that's not quite the message I was hearing from you a minute ago about this scary black guy who was beating up poor George Zimmerman, the guy who just happened to have a gun.
What was that again?
I said that is not the message that I was hearing from you 4 or 5 minutes ago when you were talking about Trayvon Martin, this scary black guy who was beating to a, your phrase, bloody pulp, something that was disputed by both the prosecution and the defense.
If you had a legitimate concealed weapon, if you had a legitimate concealed weapon, somebody broke your nose and was beating you to the place where you thought you were going to die, what would you do? Would you defend
yourself? I would turn
yourself, or
and
would you
run.
Let yourself be killed?
I would turn and run.
You'd turn and run. What if you couldn't run because he's on top of you?
I wouldn't have put myself in that situation in the first place.
You know what? I agree with you, and that would have been the great thing for Zimmerman, and it would have been the great thing for Martin to just have gone.
But the fact of the matter is that George Zimmerman initiated this entire process when he chose, against the police advice, to get out of his car with his gun in his hand and go into this confrontation with Trayvon Martin, and he is responsible for this, and it has nothing to do with what might have been on Trayvon Martin's cell phone.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think he threw the first punch, Trayvon Martin?
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
The first punch was thrown when George Zimmerman stepped out of that car.
No. It's not against the law to follow somebody in your own community.
It actually is against the law to physically assault somebody. It actually is. If you are following somebody
in a way that
makes them feel threatened under the Stand Your Ground laws in Florida, they have the right to shoot you.
Well, you know what?
But Trayvon Martin didn't have a gun. But under the Stand Your Ground law, if he saw George Zimmerman following him, which he did, and if he saw George Zimmerman chasing him, which he did, and if he had a reasonable belief in his mind at that time that George Zimmerman was going to commit bodily harm against him, which he had every reason to have, then under the Stand Your Ground law, pushed through and passed by Jeb Bush in Florida, Trayvon Martin had the right to shoot George Zimmerman. He just did not have the gun.
Why don't you want to talk about the parenting issue?
But you don't think that he had the right to even punch George Zimmerman,
apparently. Why don't you want to talk about parenting and the poor parenting of his
parents? Because his parents were not there when he was shot.
Well, you know what? They should have been there before he was shot, and he wouldn't have gotten shot.
Okay, we understand your perspective, Bill. Bill Keller, liveprayer.com is the website. Thank you, Bill.
Have a great day, buddy.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, welcome to Florida. We'll be back. It's the place where despair is not an option. I'm telling you that the work that we have, if you're concerned about the Trayvon Martin case or Juror B-37 or racism or all these other things, the immediate work that we have to do is to unmask and expose the role of the National Rifle Association and Wayne Little Peter, their $2 million a year spokesman, Wayne LaPierre, and Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida at the time in 2006, the Stand Your Ground law was passed, and point out that under this Stand Your Ground law, frankly, and I don't get it why, you know, the more I think about this, the more I'm astounded by it. Here's, you know, Florida law used to say, these used to be the jury instructions that were given in a murder case, in a capital case in Florida, prior to Jeb Bush pushing through and getting and signing the Stand Your Ground law in 2006, the ALEC NRA Stand Your Ground law. Stand your ground and shoot first is what it should be called. The Stand Your Ground and Shoot First laws. The jury instructions used to be the defendant cannot justify the use of force likely to cause death or great bodily harm unless he has used every reasonable means within his power and consistent with his own safety to avoid the danger before resorting to that force. Now, that's the standard I would submit to you that both the defense in this case and, frankly, the prosecution and virtually all of the media and all of these particularly white folks who are calling in defending George Zimmerman, that is the standard to which they are holding Trayvon Martin. That he had no right to punch George Zimmerman in the nose or beat his head against the deadly weapon of the sidewalk. He had no right to do that unless first he had tried everything else, every other way to resolve that conflict, including fleeing. That's the standard to which they are holding Trayvon Martin. The old pre-2006, pre-Jeb Bush, pre-NRA, pre-ALEC, pre-Koch Brothers law. That's the standard to which they're holding them. They're holding Trayvon Martin. The law continues. The jury instructions continue. And again, this is the standard to which they're holding Trayvon Martin. They're saying he did not have the right to punch out George Zimmerman. He should have been running home In fact, as I, you know, I was reading to you from Bill Keller's piece, Bill Keller says, the facts were, and I quote, the facts were clear that Trayvon Martin had more than enough time to get back to his father's house, but chose instead to confront Zimmerman, break his nose, and continue the violent attack. So the standard that they are holding Martin to is that he did not have the right to stand his ground, that he should have run when confronted with the possibility of violence. And in fact, the old law, pre-Alec, Koch Brothers, 2006, NRA, stand your ground and shoot first law, not only said the defendant cannot justify the use of deadly force likely to cause death or great bodily harm unless he has used every reasonable means within his force and consistent with his own safety to avoid the danger before resorting to that force, but it goes on to say the fact that the defendant was wrongfully attacked, and Trayvon Martin was certainly wrongfully attacked. He was just walking home with Skittles and iced tea. The fact that the defendant was wrongfully attacked cannot justify his use of force likely to cause death or great bodily harm if, by retreating, he could have avoided the need to use that force. That is the old law. That is the standard to which these people want to hold Trayvon Martin. Is that not clear? Does everybody not get that? I mean, Bill Keller laid it out so clearly. This is the standard for Trayvon Martin. He had time to run home. Let's sit for 4 minutes, the defense said in the courtroom. In those 4 minutes, he could have run home. Instead, he chose to beat up our client, the defendant, Mr. Zimmerman. And see, under the old law, the fact that the defendant was wrongfully attacked cannot justify his use of force likely to cause death or great bodily harm if by retreating he could have avoided the need to use that force. You get this? Trayvon Martin was put on trial by the defense in this case using the pre-2006, pre-Koch Brothers, I had Danny Goldberg on my show last night, and he kept calling them the Koch Brothers all night long. It's stuck in my head. Pre-Koch Brothers, pre-NRA, pre-Alec, pre-Stand Your Ground and Shoot First Law. Okay, this is the standard prior to 2006. That is the legal basis under which they tried Trayvon Martin both in the courtroom and in the press. Now, they used a completely different standard to try George Zimmerman. They used the post-2006, post-Koch Brothers, post-NRA, post-Alec, post-Stand Your Ground and Shoot First Law, and here are the jury instructions that were given by Judge Nelson to the jury as a result of the Stand Your Ground law. If George Zimmerman was not engaged in an unlawful activity and was attacked in any place where he had a right to be, he had no duty to retreat. And he had the right to stand his ground and meet force with force, including deadly force. You get this? George Zimmerman had that right. But nobody ever said, if Trayvon Martin was not engaged in an unlawful activity and was attacked in any place where he had a right to be, he had no duty to retreat and had the right to stand his ground and meet force with force. Nobody ever said that. At least to the best of my knowledge. Now, I did not watch every minute of the trial. But it sure seems to me like Trayvon Martin was tried in this case under the pre-Koch Brothers law, the pre-Stand Your Ground and Shoot First law. And George Zimmerman was tried under the post-Stand Your Ground and Shoot First law. Is this starting to get clear? Is this starting to make sense? Are you starting to get a handle on this?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That is the essence of the subtlety of the racism played out in this case that nobody's even pointing out or talking about. Exposing the con and conservative, Tom Hartman here with you. You know, this is a meme that I have not seen anywhere in the media. And frankly, just really hit me full right in the face in the middle of my conversation with Bill Keller. And if any of you are inclined to be writing political op-eds or, you know, regularly write for, you know, Daily Kos or Raw Story or Truthout or Alternet or whatever it may be, please take this and run with it. I'm going to write a piece about this tomorrow. But, you know, I don't think there can be too many. And that is that there are two standards by which a person historically has been judged in the state of Florida when they are confronted by somebody who they consider to be a threat. The pre-Jeb Bush, Koch Brothers, NRA, stand your ground and shoot first, Alec, the pre-2006 standard was you have to do everything you can to avoid using deadly force, including running. And if you have done everything, including running, then you can assert self-defense. The post-2006 Jeb Bush, Koch Brothers, NRA, Alec, stand your ground and shoot first is you don't have to run. You can stand your ground and shoot first. And that pre-2006 standard at law is what is being applied and was applied in the courtroom to, and in, certainly in the media, to Trayvon Martin. And the post-2006 standard is what has been applied, was applied in the courtroom by those six jurors to George Zimmerman. Tell me I'm wrong. Tell me I'm missing something. This seems to me like a major epiphany. Now, of course, I get major epiphanies all the time and then later think, well, maybe I was wrong. You know, but I don't think so. I think this is a big deal. Darren in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Darren.
Mr. H., how you doing? First-time caller. I just want to point out something in the Zimmerman case. He said that Trayvon Martin had his hand over his mouth, over his nose, and he was screaming for help at the same time. How can you do that? There's no way.
Right.
And then another thing, the defense, they blocked the state wanted to bring in analysis to listen to the voices to see if that was Zimmerman's voice or was it Trayvon's voice.
Right, and the judge said no.
The defense didn't want that to happen.
Right.
That would have been an open. That would have been a shut case if they would allow that to come in. Only thing they had to do is let Zimmerman holler help one time, and then the person would have analyzed and see if it was Zimmerman or not. Me personally, I don't believe it was Zimmerman.
Yeah.
Okay, and then another thing.
Let me add to that, Darren. If I'm the guy who's holding a loaded, and you know. It doesn't even have a safety. I was going to say with safety off. Doesn't even have a safety. I'm the guy who's got a loaded gun with hollow point bullets in it in my hand. I am not going to be the guy who is screaming, help me, help me, help me.
No, you're not. You're not.
I mean, let's just apply some simple logic here.
Yes, you're totally right. And then another thing, if Zimmerman was getting his head beat in the concrete, those were little baby scratches on the back of his head. If he got his head slammed into that concrete so hard and so rough as the defense claimed, his head would have been split wide open.
Right. Yeah, even the defense had to acknowledge that the wounds were inconsistent with George Zimmerman's assertion that he had been repeatedly smashed into the concrete. They were more consistent with his perhaps having fallen and hit his head on the concrete.
And I'm going to, Mr. H., I'm going to shift gears on you. No one brought into the fact that it really didn't have anything to do with the case, but George Zimmerman's dad is a retired judge. I think there was witness. I think there was jury temperament. I think this was set up from the word go. Zimmerman knew what was going on. I really do believe that.
Yeah. Zimmerman, well, you got a small town in rural Florida, and his dad is a white guy who's a retired judge. And the whole legal establishment decides we're not going to go after this guy's son. And then finally they're forced to, but they're still standing up for this guy's son. I had forgotten that, Darren. Thank you for reminding me.
He picked a fight with Trayvon.
Yeah.
Zimmerman knew the law. He claimed when he went on Fox News and talked to Henley or whatever his name is, he did not know the stand your ground law. But right. It came out in court that he knew it.
Right.
He picked a fight with Trayvon to do what he did.
Right.
That's what the bottom line. He stalked that boy and he killed him in cold blood.
I agree.
And that lady that was on the judge, she's claimed that there was no racial involved in it, racial profiling. It was crazy. That's the most absurd, asinine thing I have ever heard in my life.
Yep, I agree. This started with race, arguably months or years before when George Zimmerman started calling the police every time a black person drove through or walked through his neighborhood. Period. And it was saturated in race from day one. It was all about race. I've been saying that from the time of the arrest until this day. And all these frankly white racists who may not even realize that they're racist. They're sitting around going, oh, it's not about race. Let's not talk about race. Let's talk about the law. Blah, 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 blah. Well, if you want to talk about the law, then why was Trayvon Martin not entitled to stand his ground? Why is anybody concerned about the fact that George Zimmerman might have gotten beat up by Trayvon Martin if Trayvon Martin had the right to even use deadly force against him under the Stand Your Ground law? It's like there are two standards of justice being applied, one for the white guy, one for the black guy, or one for the, if you want to say, George Zimmerman, half Hispanic, half white guy, whatever you want to call him, and the other for the African-American. And I don't see that being pointed out in the media, and I wish it was. And I hope that y'all will help me get that word out, if that makes sense to you, Darren. Is my argument making sense?
Makes a lot of sense. The post George Bush, when he passed the law, what have you, and pre-post, what have you, all of that is making a lot of sense. You hit in the head, the hammer, the nail right on the head.
Okay, Darren, thank you very much. Yeah, it was Jeb Bush, but yeah, got it. Darren, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to us there in Orlando. Bill in Fort Worth, Texas. Hey, Bill, it says you disagree with me.
I do disagree with you, and if you'll let me a little leeway here, first of all, I hated that the Martin boy was shot. I agree with your pastor that you had on there. I think Trayvon's parents wasn't supervising their minor child.
Florida. Therefore, he should have been killed.
Hold on. No, I didn't say that. And don't put those words in my mouth, sir. What I'm saying with you is Florida is the lightning capital of the world. His parents let him out in a thunderstorm. And I don't even, the evidence, I did listen to all the evidence in this trial, by the way, Tom. And that, when you have a lease, if that was a lease situation that, Tracy Martin's, girlfriend or whatever she was to him that he was living in or whatever, in these leases, you gotta put on your lease who is on that property. And most,
I don't understand what you're talking about, Bill.
Well, what I'm talking about is that Trayvon wasn't no Boy Scout. And
so in order to be not shot, if you're a black man in Florida going to the 7-Eleven to buy candy, you've got to wear a Boy Scout uniform.
He was murdering and trespassing is what my point is.
He was not trespassing.
How did you know that?
Well, nobody suggested he was. Even the defense never suggested Trayvon was trespassing.
What you're suggesting ain't evidence either. And he wasn't tried on stand your ground. He was tried on self-defense. And yes, Trayvon...
George Zimmerman was tried on self-defense as modified by the stand your ground laws. Here is the jury instruction. If George Zimmerman was not engaged in an unlawful activity and was attacked in any place where he had a right to be, he had no duty to retreat, and he had the right to stand his ground and meet force with force, including deadly force. That is lifted right out of the Koch brothers, NRA, Alec, Stand Your Ground law, Bill. That's lifted right out of the Stand Your Ground law. Jeffrey in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tom, you're the smartest person I know on the left side. Why has the Republicans turned their stars upside down and started using the satanic star of Lucifer
on their logo? This started in 2000. For our listeners who don't know what you're talking about, I raise this question about once a month, and whenever I get a new Republican on my TV show, I ask them, and we'll show the GOP logo. If you go to GOP.org, if you go to the Republican, any Republican website, and it blows my mind, actually, that of all the networks, the one that most likely, most frequently gets it wrong is MSNBC. They flip the stars back right side up. But the Republicans in 2000, when George Bush was running for president, they flipped the stars on their logo, those three stars on the elephant, they flipped them upside down. So instead of being the American star that was the equivalent of Leonardo da Vinci's, you know, human, you know, with the head on the top, two arms out on the side, two legs stretched out on the bottom, instead of that right side up star, the Republicans flipped it upside down, so it became two horns on the top, the, you know, the goat, the satanic goat. Two horns on the top, two big ear flaps on the side, and the chinny chin chin on the bottom. And I have not yet been able to get a single Republican to explain to me why they did that. None of them will explain why the GOP is using the satanic star in their logo. And I'm just asking. If anybody knows, give me a call and let me know. I've been asking this question for years.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, it kind of started when Karl Rove came along. And Karl Rove, I mean, if anybody's made a deal with the devil, maybe. Anyhow, welcome back. It's Tom Hartman here with you. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is in the studio with us. Hey, Ellen. Welcome.
I am. And
so nice to see you.
It's good to see you. Lots going on, particularly even with you. I'm all excited, but I'm not supposed to say anything.
Okay. Yes. We'll wait.
All right. So let's just talk. I know you were just talking about Stand Your Ground.
Yes.
Al Sharpton was in front of the Justice Department today. He's going to have Justice for Trayvon rallies this Saturday. They're going to be taking place in the federal courthouses or on federal courthouses steps in L.A., Chicago, Philadelphia, New York. Next week, there's going to be a conference in Miami on the Stand Your Ground law.
Good.
Now, my view, honestly, let me just give you my view, is that I would hope that if you're going to do these rallies, they're with the idea of changing legislation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because
I think
without that...
No, I don't think the Justice Department can or will do anything right now with regard to civil rights. I think that what we have to do is point out we have 31 states where the Koch brothers and Alec and the NRA have passed this toxic Stand Your Ground and Shoot First legislation. And that was actually part of the jury instructions that was given to this jury, that George Zimmerman had the right to stand his ground and use deadly force, even if he did not have deadly force used against him. Whereas prior to 2006, the law was that even if you're confronted with deadly force, you have an obligation to run. And that is the standard that was applied to Trayvon Martin. They're all asking the question, why didn't Trayvon Martin run? Well, that was the pre-2006 law. Why are they judging Trayvon Martin by the pre-2006 standard, and they're judging George Zimmerman by the post-2006 standard? This, to me, betrays a level of perhaps unconscious racism in our media and in our legal system.
Well, there's a lot of unconscious racism in our media, and also the way this was covered.
Yes.
Was, I think...
And continues to be.
And continues to be.
Yeah, okay. So what else is going on?
The nuclear option. So they basically...
Sort of half-nuclear option.
Well, they decided not to use it, except...
Right.
The agreement that John McCain came up with Harry Reid is the two NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board people that President Obama nominated, will go out the window, and then they'll nominate two other ones, and that those two people will get through. So it's just a face-saving issue because he could nominate people who were even more left than the people he nominated that weren't very left.
Right.
So,
but I, in the original offer that was made by McCain, it was you can nominate two more people, but we get to approve it. Now they're not asserting that any longer.
Well,
so this is just
they're
going to
approve it, but I think it's face saving. I mean, obviously,
okay.
Obama's not going to. He's not going to.
He's not going to nominate two
you
Republicans.
And me, and he's not going to nominate two Republicans. So
okay.
He's going to go take the middle ground that's going to keep everybody happy,
right. Which is the way.
Because it's politics in Washington.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Steny Hoyer had a pen and pencil this morning. He said that he was very disappointed in the farm bill, particularly the food stamp bill, and he wondered if it comes up as a separate bill, which they claim it's going to, how many Republicans are really going to vote for it. Now, there has actually also been a study, the U.S. PIRG, which is the U.S. Public Interest Group, said that 4% of agribusinesses eat up 74% of all the subsidies.
Wow. Of all the subsidies that are part of the farm bill that the Republicans just passed in the House, that's going to 4% of all the ag businesses?
Yes, so another agribusiness.
So it's probably like 0.01% of the American companies are getting 74% of all the money.
I don't know, but the point is that if you have only 4% out of 100, so let's say 100 companies, only 4% of them, there's probably 1,000 companies, but whatever, are getting them, which means, you know, they're going to be those top companies.
Yeah, it's
going to
be ConAgra and Monsanto and ADM.
Exactly.
And,
those are the guys that are getting the subsidies.
Amazing.
So it's not your local average farmer who has
so
his little
company. So when Bob Schieffer on Meet the Press asked that Republican congressman, he said, you know, you gave millions, billions of dollars in arguably welfare to corporations and you didn't give a penny in food to poor people. You know, isn't this corporate welfare? And the guy tried to weasel out of it.
Oh, he did try to weasel out. It was an amazing piece of weaseling.
Yeah, yeah. But that really is the question.
It could be in any classroom on how to weasel.
Yeah.
Okay. So Standing Hoyer is pretty upset about that. Now, it's very interesting today at the United Nations, the head of the Security Council was speaking to the American temporary representative and said the number of Syrian refugees in Lebanon is the equivalent to having 75 million people in America there.
Wow. 75 people in America would be like, what, 20%?
75 million, yeah.
20%
exactly.
of our population.
Right.
So it's like the 20% of the population of Lebanon is now Syrian refugees.
Exactly.
That's incredible.
And they said they just can't handle it.
Oh, yeah.
Of course
yeah.
not. So that's another issue. Mr. Snowden applied for temporary asylum in Russia today.
Yep.
Jay Carney said it's not an embarrassment to the U.S. that he's applying in South America. Well, of course it is, but he's not going to say that.
Sure.
Eric Holder is giving his speech to the NAACP conference, I believe, early tonight. Senators Cruz and Paul backed Senator Gillibrand's military sexual assault bill today. Mm. This has to do with the issue of the chain of command.
Yeah, and I think this is one of those areas where they figure, as Republican Tea Partiers who are taking a lot of flack over the so-called war on women and all the anti-abortion stuff that's going on down in Texas, keep in mind, Ted Cruz is the senator from Texas, that this allows them to somewhat redeem themselves with women, or at least appear to. I think they're just throwing a bone to the dog, as the old phrase goes.
Right. Exactly.
Because they don't care. I mean, this is not their issue.
It isn't their issue, but that's what's coming up. Just I want to go quickly on the Eric Holder speech.
Sure.
He says...
But you have the text of the speech.
I do have
that
the
he
text.
Has yet to give.
That he
has
let...
Boy,
yet,
are you on the inside
right,
here.
Right, I'm on the inside here. Trayvon Martin's death, he said, caused me to sit down and have a conversation with his 15-year-old son. He said, as important as it is, I'm determined to do everything in my power to ensure that the kind of talk I had with my son isn't the only conversation we engage in. So it doesn't sound like, so far, that they're necessarily going to come up with something, but it does sound like they're going to try and push for more discussion, dialogue, whatever, with local AGs, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. See, I think if they actually did anything, that the wrath of the drudges of the world would come down on their heads in ways that would be unimaginable. Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and the great work that they're doing where you can help a freed slave with a goat or by buying a crystal necklace. As
right here,
Alan
folks.
Is right. There you go. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, here's my summary of this. And again, I mean, you know, it's maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I'm just missing something altogether. But why is it that mostly white media and mostly white commentators and an entire white judicial system down in Florida, white judge, white prosecutors, white defense lawyers, and white people who come on, like on this program, and you know, why is it that they are holding Trayvon Martin to the standard of he shouldn't have thrown a punch because he didn't know that his life was in danger? Assuming he did throw a punch. I mean, we don't even know that. But why are they holding him to the standard of he shouldn't have thrown a punch when they're not holding George Zimmerman to that same standard? Instead, they're holding George Zimmerman to the standard of, well, he had the right to kill somebody if he was afraid. I realize this is a variation on the question that's been asked by people in the African-American community for some time now about didn't Trayvon Martin have the right to stand his ground? But I think that this is even more overt in some ways and more subtle in some ways. It reveals a thought process in the white community and the white media that in all probability is no surprise to the African-American community in the United States. In fact, I'm guessing that probably a lot of our African-American listeners and viewers are going, gee, you finally got it? I mean, I've been talking about two standards of justice in this country forever. I mean, you know, one for banksters and the other for people who rob 7-Elevens. So, I mean, that's, but this even goes beyond that. Anyhow, anything goes summer. Let's get your calls in here. Kevin in Toronto, Canada. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am well.
What's up? Thank you.
Are you Canadian or an American expat?
I'm an American expat, married to a Canadian here, and just moved recently within the last 2 weeks here to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I've been here 3 months prior to my complete move, and so I've lived this with Canadian citizens and the question of stand your ground and how they felt about the Trayvon Martin case.
Right.
And today, I had a very poignant conversation with one of the guys that I work with, and he thought that, you know, Trayvon Martin deserved what he got. And I said, how do you figure that? And previously we've had conversations about he and his family, so I knew that he had a daughter. And I said, you know, John, let me ask you a question. If Fiona was walking home one night from the store and she was in her neighborhood and she noticed that somebody was following her, so she started to run as if you would tell her that, and she did so. And then when she thought she lost him, she started to walk. And then again, he appeared. And as Fiona ran, let's just say for given sake, Fiona actually made it home and had the conversation. Dad, somebody's out there following me. What would you do? And his answer to me was, well, I would have went out there with my baseball bat and I'd have killed the guy. And I said, but you have less respect for Trayvon Martin because Trayvon Martin was a child at that point. Just if Trayvon Martin was a...
It doesn't matter. I mean, if Trayvon Martin had been 50 years old, he would have had the right to defend himself if somebody was harassing him, if somebody was stalking him.
And I agree, but I believe that there's been a circumspect where people are not viewing it as, you know, I think you made the comment yesterday, it's the fight that they're viewing. They're not viewing everything prior to the fight.
Right.
What progressed up to that fight?
Right.
And that's what throws me. As adults, we sit here and we look at situations that, you know, there's no way concrete couldn't have been a, you know, concrete is not a weapon. It's never been a weapon, you know. And I think that George Zimmerman fired that gun, and it was so close to him, and he was so reactive that gun broke his nose. You know, I thought that, you know, the scars on the back of his head was because they were fighting in the rain. He slipped on the sand. He slipped on the, you know, on grass as he was trying to accost this young boy, and he fell backwards. I mean, to me, I thought that there were so many other things that weren't brought to fruition. So yesterday you asked a question, and I thought it was very poignant. Who failed Trayvon Martin? And I believe we as Americans failed Trayvon Martin. Mm. Because we have allowed our justice system to be hijacked, our political system to be hijacked, our system in general and our minds to be hijacked, to believe that we can't have this race as a conversation. We can't have this conversation in a menial way. Two callers before me, the young man was saying, well, you know, he believes in, you know, his parents weren't watching him. He was 17 years old. He just went to the store. What was there to watch?
Yeah.
You know, how many times do we just send our kids to the store? For us, 17, go, you're
yeah, he had been home playing video games for 5 hours prior to that, and he was coming back home to finish playing the video game.
Exactly.
I mean, welcome to average American teenager.
Exactly. I have a 21-year-old. I have 2 5-year-old twins, a boy and a girl, and I'm concerned now that, you know, we as a society as a whole are not being our brother's keeper. We're not watching our kids, and we're allowing, you know, society as a whole, our skewed social structure, to start dictating what we should be as a people. Mm. So America has failed him. America as a whole, as we argue amongst ourselves about the right thing, a grown man should not be chasing someone else's child, no matter where he is. A grown man should allow the police to do their job, even if you're armed. You're armed, you're satisfied enough that nothing's going to happen to you in your car because you're armed. There's no need for you to get out of your vehicle and chase anyone. You're grown. It's a child. I followed him. This is where he is. You told me not to follow, but I did drive up behind him, and he went this way, and he went into that house, and he may be stealing. That could have been the end of the story. You know, we always end up in America with people who own guns, and I'm an ex-military person. I own guns. But we always end up with people who own guns having that simple mistake of, oh, well, I did something. Mm. That is, you know, to own a gun is to own the punishment which goes with using of it. And I think that's not expressed enough here in the United States.
Yeah.
That our ownership of a gun.
I'm curious, Kevin, I totally get what you're saying, and I do not disagree with any of it. I'm curious. You've been in Canada for, you've been there for a few weeks. You've been basically hanging out there or spending most of your time there for a few months. Am I correct in, I mean, it's been years since I was in Canada. I have spent a fair amount of time in Canada, but it's been decades. And it used to be that the principal news source that I saw in Canada, and we used to get Canadian television when we lived in Detroit, we'd get, you know, from the stations in Windsor, and that was back before cable, I mean, back in the 70s when everything was over the air. The principal stuff, the principal source of news was CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Is that still the principal source of news there?
Yes, it is, but now we filtered into, if you have cable, you get everything from Buffalo to Rochester.
Okay, so you get the U.S. news as well. How is the Canadian news, I mean, in the United States, outside of MSNBC, which is doing a good job of conveying the outrage of the African-American community about this, all the other networks are pretty much, you know, playing the whole, you know, George Zimmerman had the right to defend himself. Trayvon Martin did not have the right to defend himself. He should have run. He could have gotten home in time, blah-de-blah-de-blah. How's the Canadian media playing this?
They're actually playing it very, just as news pre-1990s.
Hmm.
Fair and balanced.
Yeah,
truly
which is
fair and balanced.
What they're required to do by law in Canada now, or, you know.
That's correct. That is correct. And they continue to do that, Tom. And I think it's so refreshing because you don't have that complete lie and then a rebuttal for a lie.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have that. You actually have fact-based news. And that fact-based news plays, in the Trayvon Martin case, it plays differently on both sides. And it's kind of funny to see.
Very, very interesting. Kevin, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to iHeartRadio there in Toronto, Canada. Thanks for listening to the show. We'll be right back. And thanks for calling. We'll be right back. It is 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
NBC News. Now, this is back in 2012. They reported this, that George Zimmerman was charged with resisting an officer with violence. Back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. John in Neosho, Missouri. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi. I just wanted to make a point about manslaughter. I was looking at that, and there were actually three different conditions, you know, manslaughter 1, 2, and 3.
Under Florida law.
Under Florida law. Manslaughter 1 is intent. Inexcusable nor justified, ultimately resulting in death. 2 is a procurement, so you get somebody else to kill somebody.
Right.
Then 3 is by culpable negligence, which involves engaging in culpably negligent conduct that leads to death.
Right. At the very least, George Zimmerman should have been convicted of that.
Exactly. And I think that if you listen to the juror last night, you'll see that she indicated on several occasions that that's exactly what would have happened, including how she felt about it, because she even made reference to the fact that she felt that both of them were guilty or both of them were responsible. We can't do anything to Trayvon. Obviously, he's dead. But she's basically saying that Zimmerman is responsible.
Right. She said he made a bad choice.
Right. So this fits under manslaughter 3. In other words, his actions by getting out of the car, chasing after him, his actions led to the murder.
Yeah.
And this is what's interesting to me is that if I were the prosecuting attorney, why would I pick two charges? Like first was second, you know, murder 2, which requires intent. And then why would I follow up with another one, which is manslaughter 1, which requires intent, and not have manslaughter 3? Because basically, if you don't get intent, you lose them both.
Right. Well, that's a question you'd have to ask the prosecutors. Let's keep in mind that George Zimmerman's dad was a retired judge in this community. In all probability, the judge and the prosecutors were friends or acquaintances with his dad. This is a small town in Florida. I'm purely speculating here now, but I have not heard much discussion about this, and I'm not sure why. It may be that there's no discussion about it because it's completely irrelevant. I'm totally off the wall on this, and they actually, you know, grew up, and his dad was an active judge all those years in Alaska, and they just moved to Florida to retire. But if his dad was a judge in that community, then that might have something to do with why law enforcement took the stand and said that George Zimmerman seemed like a credible witness. It might be why the prosecution took a charge, manslaughter 1 rather than manslaughter 3, that was a lot harder to prove. And it might be why the judge in her jury instructions excluded that whole issue of in fact, we went off on this at some length yesterday. The Florida statute that said that, here we go. This is called initial aggressor. It was the initial aggressor instruction, which says that you cannot claim self-defense as your defense if you were the guy who started the incident in which you ended up having to defend yourself. And that is in Florida law, and Judge Nelson, at the request of defense attorney Don West, excluded that from the jury instructions.
Right.
And they had a debate about that in open court when the jury was not present. And, yes. You know, so a lot of this looks to me like a stacked deck. But
exactly. It seems as if every chance, every opportunity for something to go either way always fell to Zimmerman.
Yeah. I absolutely agree, John. And as to the reason why, I mean, that's something else that we'd have to ask. I don't know the answer why. Devon in White Lake, Michigan. Hey, Devon, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
That was my whole point on this, too. A very tragic comedy of errors. And if there was a sheriff who lost his job because he would not charge.
Prosecute. Yeah.
Prosecute because he said there wasn't enough evidence and maybe it should go to a grand jury. And maybe the grand jury would have come up with, you know, negligent homicides, charged and convicted of negligent homicide, charged and convicted of some type of manslaughter.
Right.
It's obvious they couldn't get him on his murder, too. So,
yeah.
I mean,
I agree. And I think that the reason why the cop, why the lead investigator who was on the stand saying, I trusted George Zimmerman, and that was, according to juror B37, that was like one of the huge things that influenced the jury. By the way, after the judge said, do not be influenced by that statement, it's inadmissible, should not be part of the evidence, that maybe one of the reasons why he said that was because it was his initial call to say, there's no there. We're going to let this guy go. We're not going to arrest him. We're not going to take his blood. We're not going to breathalyze him. I mean, you know, holy cow, there was pot in Trayvon Martin's bloodstream from maybe a week ago. Well, nobody has any idea what was in George Zimmerman's bloodstream because they didn't bother to take any. And, you know, it's like, go ahead.
I think it was handled wrong from the start. You know, that probably should have gone to a grand jury. And
I think it was handled wrong from the start because the dead guy was a black teenager, and the police for 24 hours did not know that he actually lived in and belonged in that neighborhood. They assumed he was you know, somebody from outside who was not supposed to be there, you know, to quote the old slave patrol laws. Devon, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Jason in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Jason. A quick question. We've got a minute here.
Oh, hey, Tom. Okay, I got one comment with a disclaimer and
go for it.
Two
quick
plugs, if that's all right. Now, the first comment would be with the disclaimer is I hate white people. And I'm a 36-year-old white man. So, are
okay.
You still there?
I am. I'm confused, but I'm here.
Oh, okay. Well, I hate white people. I'm a 36-year-old white man, and I think that this country is so racially divided, it's disgusting. And now I think you know where I'm coming from with that. Now, the next thing is a plug. I have read almost every one of your books, and I love them. They're great. And I suggest that everybody goes and buys Tom Hartman's books.
Well, thank
you,
Jason.
And the second plug is for Democratic Socialists of America, DSAUSA.org.
Okay. And you know, I'm with you, Jason. Democratic Socialists are great. It's got nothing to do with Hart. Of course it is. Anything goes summer. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So how come nobody's talking about two completely different pre-2006, 2000, post-2006 standards of justice? Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Don in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, I've been holding off, waiting to talk to you. You know, we're snowbirds, and we go down there in the wintertime in Minnesota. But, you know, the supposedly the night that this happened, okay, they had Zimmerman down at the police station almost immediately. I was watching the whole thing unfold, and the crazy part of it is that he didn't have any bumps or bruises, broken noses, or nothing that appeared in that visit to the police station. I don't know if it's just something that they decided that he better have something to show. And at 17 years old, if I was walking down the street and some guy's following me, and I'm looking at him, and he's harassing me enough to where I finally turn around and say, hey, what do you want? Get away from me, whatever, and end up, if you have to swing at the guy, I mean, you harass somebody enough, they're going to retaliate. And that's exactly what happened. I agree with your philosophy 100% that, you know, they're using two systems to judge. But I also agree with the caller that indicated that this whole thing is a complete setup by the Sanford police, the whole nine yards. I just can't understand how they could even, I mean, the guy admitted, I killed him.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have since learned, by the way, that his dad was a judge from 2000 to 2006 in Virginia, not in Florida. Although, George Zimmerman, this is from NBC News, now in 2005, when he was 20, George Zimmerman was arrested and charged with resisting an officer with violence and battery of law enforcement against a law enforcement officer, both third-degree felonies. That charge was reduced to resisting an officer without violence and then waived when he entered an alcohol education program. And then in August 2005, his ex-fiancée, Veronica Zuazo, filed a restraining order, a civil restraining order, alleging domestic violence. And he counterfiled for a restraining order against her. The competing claims were resolved by both of them being granted. And in December 2006, he was charged with speeding. That case was dismissed when the officer failed to show up in court. You know, we hear about Trayvon Martin had, you know, remnants of pot in his bloodstream that might have been from a week earlier. Who knows? I don't recall anybody pointing out that George Zimmerman had a restraining order